Welcome to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look, where you, the investor, get to listen as Chris Perry grills the best and the brightest in the corporate sector to help you find out who's the wheat and who's the chaff. Listen in.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily shared by people who are wrong.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Equity Guru podcast. We're talking to CEO and founder of Biome, Khurram Malik. Khurram, you're out there on the East Coast, which I think maybe takes you a little bit out of the Vancouver investor mindset a little bit, but you guys are doing some really interesting things out in the East.
It does. We're headquartered in Toronto, but most things we do in Canada are in Atlantic Canada. It is a bit of an isolated part of the world. So when we do announce things, even Ontario somewhat ignores, but that's just opportunity for investors to realize unrealized value.
So far you guys are doing that. You've moved pretty quickly into the provincial liquor system. Tell me if you could, the difference between an offtake agreement and a purchase order, because I think a lot of people may be missing that fine point.
Sure. So pretty much any licensed producer in Canada gets regular purchase orders. We get them as well. Almost every 2 weeks, we get a new purchase order from the Nova Scotia Liquor Control Board on a go-forward basis from the Newfoundland Liquor Control Board. A purchase order is simply a short-term document that says, okay, we need an X amount of product for a couple of weeks, and then we'll get back to you with another purchase order. It's really not worth much more than that. An offtake supply agreement is an entirely different animal. In our case, if you look at Newfoundland, it's really a 20-year economic agreement. It's a multi-year commitment on both sides to do a variety of things. And there's very few of those that have been signed in Canada. I think if you look at ours in Newfoundland, at least, it's a three-year offtake agreement just for the kilograms. Most offtakes are 1 or 2 years. That's unusual. Number two, got several other bells and whistles in there. Like we had 5 retail locations. It's an overall economic agreement. Almost no licensed producer in Canada has even 1 retail location. And my favorite part about that is not the kilograms, which is, I think, the 4th largest purchase commitment any province has made in Canada to date of 24,000 kilograms. It's a nice headline number. But the best part is we're building a facility there that's going to cost about $60 million to build. The Newfoundland Liquor Control Board is going to give us half of that, $52 million of the $60 back over a 5-year period in sales rebates. So when you look at a return on invested capital in that province, it doesn't really get better than that if we're getting $52 million of that back. And the way we get it back is we split the NLC sales commissions every time we sell something in the province. So our margins are just higher than they would be otherwise.
So you sort of compare that to most of the other LPs around that are just like buy some or grow some, but largely buy some in a lot of instances, and then sell it back for a tiny margin and then repeat until such time as there's enough supply out there that no one wants their product anymore.
I agree. Taking a step further back, I mean, just looking at how we've designed this company, if you look at the sort of the more recent licensed producers, they're very risky investments for investors to get exposure to. So we thought, how can we build not only a more efficient cannabis platform, but also a considerably less risky cannabis platform? And if you look at our pedigree, even before we did cannabis in the early days, it's power, renewable power specifically around the world. Now, the way you build a renewable power plant is you get a 20-year power purchase agreement with an off-taker, and then you go build a plant. So unfortunately, it's not quite that attractive in cannabis, but we get the purchase orders, or sorry, the supply agreements first, and then we build our facilities to meet our supply commitments. It's an entirely different risk profile than any other cannabis company in Canada, where they'll build a facility, pick any square footage, 10,000 to 1 million square feet, and then hope there's a customer for today, and then hope there's a customer for tomorrow. We sell out our production before we even start building our facilities generally. So it's a dramatically different risk profile. It takes a little longer to get from point A to point B, but there are going to be a lot of bankruptcies in the sector in the next little while. And the only thing that'll really matter, and even the largest licensed producers will tell you this, who's got contracted offtakes? Because at some point, anyone can grow, and we can buy wholesale product from other people. We don't have to be farmers. That's not really where I want to be in this business. I want to build brands and have offtakes, and we sit in the middle of it and be where the value-added margins are versus upstream where things will commoditize and what we're sort of doing. And then for a company of our size to be signing such large supply agreements, offtake agreements, there is nobody else doing that except for the 2 or 3 or 4 largest cannabis companies in Canada. So that makes this somewhat unusual.
So you've got the majority of investors out there that are just looking at square footage and assigning a value to it. But you're playing the longer game where when that 1 million square foot is suddenly all filled, there's an oversupply. There's not an undersupply. In that oversupply situation, there's a lot of companies there that are paying huge heating bills in
wintry climates, maybe not exactly doing the thing on margins, that are going to be in a little trouble.
I agree. Even right now, some of the small and mid-sized licensed producers are feeling that anxiety of what comes next. Right now, there's not enough supply, so everyone's happy in terms of what they can get out the door. They probably sell for decent prices. But we're already negotiating wholesale contracts because we will never produce enough product ourselves internally in the history of this company on a go-forward basis to meet the demand side of what we're securing here and overseas. So we will always need other people's product. It's just a matter of finding the right product at the right price point. And from the very recent conversations right now, so the mid-sized LPs in Ontario and BC, they're a little nervous. So they're actually giving us some pretty interesting price points that you would be surprised with when we started announcing them the next little while for wholesale, provide more product to Atlantic Canada in this case. So that's already happening today because they're being pragmatic about this, what I call the day of judgment you're referring to, right? At some point, it's going to be an oversupply. I think it's going to happen late 2020 at the earliest, but that's not that far away.
The problem, obviously, for a lot of companies isn't buying weed. It's buying sellable weed right now. There are a lot of guys out there growing stuff that really is not up to par and is being passed around as third-party product. What are you doing to make sure that you're not stuck on the wrong end of that equation?
I agree. So if you go to Nova Scotia, where our first licensed producer is commercial, we've got the highest rated product in that province. If you go to any retail store in Nova Scotia and ask them which product are consumers demanding more than anyone else, I can pretty much guarantee they'll say the Highland Grove product, which is our provincial brand and facility in that province. So we've built a sort of a reputation already of providing very dense, high quality buds. I'm not going to ruin it by taking some third party product, which is substandard, just to jack up the cash flow so you can afford a high quarter. So we've been working on this for several months. We're building relationships with small to mid-sized LPs that we feel can give us relatively close to what we have. Obviously, we're not going to brand a necessary Highland Grove product. That'll be Highland Curate or something to that effect. Yeah, it's hard to find. But if you give them a multi-year commitment, provided they hit their marks and they know that there'll be some sort of certainty for them, we get some interesting pricing for that higher-end product. There's not a lot of it out there, but there's enough out there that we can sort of leverage that anxiety I was referring to earlier so they can have a customer now and have a customer next year and when things get bad. Because, we're going to need more for the remaining history of this company than we could ever produce internally. And the other thing we're doing is microgrows. So if you want the highest quality product in the sector on a go-forward basis, it'll be these micro-cultivation licenses, at least how we do it. And you'll see a little more detail on that in the next little while. But if you there's a lot of bench strength in the gray and black market right now with so-called master growers in the MMAR market as well. They're good at growing small artisanal square facilities, right? When you start making them industrial scale, that's where they all fall apart. So having micro-growers grow one genetic and master that one genetic and supplying it to us at an advantageous price point will allow us to have some very high quality product. And at the end of the day, yes, it'll be an oversupply situation. You can build great brands, but as long as you're at the higher end of the quality range, you can still have a decent business even if everything else is falling apart around you, because that'll always stand out from the crowd. And again, we have no interest in being a large player in Canada. We're going to be a small to mid-sized player here. It's our home country. It's a beachhead, but everything we do in Canada is really an excuse to leverage to do much larger things overseas. So we're going to do things in very specific ways where it maximizes our international brand presence and expertise and providing a high quality product with clinical backing as well. So we're not going to be out there just pumping out volumes of so-so product because it doesn't serve our international credibility.
Back in the day when this was all a couple of ideas and some mining shells, you and your colleague, Sasha Jacob at Jacob Securities, were really the leaders of the financing space in weed. There are a lot of companies out there that are in the top three, top five that you guys got off the ground. This is something a little different. And it's really interesting to me that having gone the large scale route early, that you've sort of honed in your business in a way that maybe the rest of the market hasn't paid enough attention to.
I'm glad you brought that up. So yes, we went early, we were aggressive. So we did a lot of things first in this industry, but also we didn't just raise money as investment backers. We were consultants as well. We helped sort of build these businesses. We brought redid business plans, redesigned growth facilities, brought technology and clinical strategies, customer acquisition strategies. So we've grown with the early leaders in space and found out what works and doesn't work. So, those nuances, which aren't typically obvious to a new license holder, which they have to learn the hard way. We already know. So what that allows us to do is if we take a single investor dollar in, we're pretty good at stretching that quite a bit to get maximum investor return, or invested in places where it'll result in investor return 6 months or 12 months online, better than your typical newbie license. The other thing is it sort of gave us a rationalization that, okay, we're going to be a little later to the game with biome as a cannabis company. I can't replicate what Canopy or Metrum or Gadigram or former clients did, right? Or even some of their smaller clients. It doesn't make any sense. We can't compete toe-to-toe with them. So we've got to find a more efficient, unique way of doing it. So that requires us to be rather pragmatic when it comes to Canada, which is why we're Atlantic-Canadian focused, which we can get into if you'd like. But realistically, it's about going overseas where there's no competition right now in the jurisdictions we're going into. In some cases, we're helping to write the regs in some of these countries. In some cases, we're convincing jurisdictions to even start a medical program, for example. So that's how we're sort of structuring ourselves. I have no interest in competing against the big guys head-on at any point in the near future. We're just going where the opportunity is being ignored. So it's a different risk profile. It's a heck of a lot more work. But I think it'll pay off well for investors when you see some of the stuff that's coming down the line in the next few months. And that's the fact that it's just a more efficient cannabis platform that's taking advantage of opportunities either being ignored or problems that are plaguing the sector investors may not realize that we're trying to fix through biome. So whether it's better corporate governance or it's better use of more efficient designs for production facilities or just building a better cannabis brand where it's tailored specifically for the needs of your target market instead of a pan-Canadian general brand, which is great if you're a Canopy and they do it well, but I don't have their balance sheet. So I've got to pick my spots.
Their balance sheet is interesting that they've certainly acquired a lot of product and resold it as quickly as they can in an effort to build that number one brand. But there's a lot of stuff in the details there, suffering margins and problems with quality control. And certainly the product at the end of it all hasn't necessarily been of the highest quality. Do you think that despite their size, that there will become competitors to them that maybe don't even exist right now, or at least are in small part just based on who catches a wave with consumers?
Look, with Canopy's balance sheet, you can do a lot of things other people can't. I think Canopy's done more things right in this industry than any other company, which is why they've got a market cap where it's at. Yes, you're right. But I think their thesis is simply, look, let's get as much market share in any possible way we can. And then we'll worry about the ramifications later because we'll be able to smooth it out. Because it's hard to raise capital in the space right now if you're new on the scene. It was easier 12 months ago. It was easier 12 months before that. So there's a natural barrier to entry for someone sort of butting out head against them. So if they've locked down a good chunk of the Canadian market, no matter what their losses are, they feel that'll be enough to squeeze out the smaller guys. And that competition won't be there later on, even if they've got a higher quality product. I think it's a legitimate way of doing it, but only one or two companies can actually get away with it.
Part of the fuel for that business plan is to find others to acquire. Do you get the sense that we're getting close to a point where the rampant gobbling up of smaller players is set to begin?
I wouldn't disagree with that. I think in terms of domestic gobbling up, I think the big guys have sort of finished up what they're going to do. I don't think they need to gobble up any more companies. I think they're just going to squeeze them and let them go by the wayside. Unless there's the occasional one that comes up with just unique IP in there they want to acquire, or they're in some other international jurisdiction in which they get into via acquiring. I think Aurora made the Nuvera acquisition for that reason, where it allowed them to get into Europe, not because of what Nuvera was doing in Canada. Yeah, I don't think the big guys are going to be out there acquiring any significant small to medium-sized companies. They may acquire another large-ish company, which we've seen a few of those happening, whether it's a Medrelief or whatever. But I think if these smaller companies of our size think that if we do a couple of things, maybe we'll be attracted to take out Canada because we're doing what we're doing domestically. I think we've got a rude awakening coming because the large folks have spread themselves out far enough now with production facilities in enough provinces that they really are not that interested. I think Bruce Linton's gone on record saying, we're done making Canadian grow acquisitions.
Mm. Where does that leave you? Are you looking to make acquisitions in the Canadian market? You've certainly got the beachhead in the east, but does the west present any opportunities for you?
We're not one of the big guys, at least not at this point. We've used Canada as a beachhead to do everything overseas. That's where most of our sales. We're an international medical platform with a little bit of recreational in Canada. If we were to acquire anything beyond what we've already got undertaken in Canada, which is Atlantic Canada and our one facility in Ontario, which frankly will be supplying Atlantic Canada, not selling in Ontario, it would have to be once the shakeout happens and we can buy something that's for cents on the dollar down the line, late 2020, early 2021. Again, we'd have to be careful because I personally do not like the way almost every facility in Canada has been designed in terms of on the production side. They're just badly built facilities from the big guys to the small guys, and we build our facilities in a very unique way. If I can get it really cheap and go in and retrofit it to get it up and running, perhaps. But at some point, I'd rather just grow overseas or have someone grow overseas and let us bring it back into the country. So it'll have to be a cheap acquisition price, something that wouldn't be too much of a pain to retrofit. And number three, the regs in Canada, which have to change dramatically, which would allow me to grow on a much more economical basis than what we can currently. because we grow some of the most expensive weed in the world right now. And that's just because of the regs. There's nothing, anything else. Jurisdictions in Europe are cheaper, and they've got higher power rates and higher labor costs, and they can still produce cheaper, which is, you know, ridiculous.
Are you specifically referring to outdoor grows?
No, indoor grows as well. I mean, my problem with outdoor grows, I mean, is you're never going to get a quality product. I mean, if you look at our facilities, yeah, we have some hybrid greenhouses on the books for design that we may expand into, but we're mostly small artisanal indoor facilities, which are difficult to run and difficult to build and expensive to build, but that's the only way you're going to get decent quality out the door. And they're highly, highly automated, which is our secret sauce. I try to engineer the human being out of the grow equation as much as possible, which is dramatically lacking in this industry right now, with the exception of maybe one. Aurora is doing in Edmonton, which is interesting, but and a few, one or few others, almost every other facility in Canada is so low tech, it's ridiculous. If you look at other parts of agriculture, you know, there's so much more automation because the margins are so thin, you have to earn a living. In the cannabis space, people have just been lazy. And the margins have been thicker on the medical side, and Canadians are generally risk-averse to trying new technology. They're just large rectangular boxes with way too many people running around trying to grow a plant.
You're listening to the Equity.Guru podcast with your host, Chris Perry.
Just a quick note to tell you, sorry to interrupt your interview, but if you want more of these, you need to go to your podcast player, whatever that podcast player is, and go and subscribe to the Equity Guru podcast. You can do that through iTunes. You can do it through Google Play. You can do it through all the places. Equity Guru podcast. Do it now.
Welcome back.
Do you think if the U.S. regulations change and it becomes legal there that your global plan suddenly focused down in that country, or is that just going to be too hard a basket to really penetrate?
That will cause a bit of a curveball potentially for everybody. We are right now assuming that we're not going to be in the U.S., but we'll look at it when it comes around. The good thing with us is we're looking at jurisdictions with enormous populations, which will keep us busy for quite some time. We may end up doing something U.S. if it makes sense. But, you know, when we are a smaller company with a smaller bandwidth, you got to pick the low hanging fruit. You can't do everything. But, yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, if it goes legal federally, you know, that can be, depending on cross-border treaties and all that work in terms of trade, again, it's probably going to be cheaper to grow in the U.S. than it is in Canada. So if Canada gets protectionist, then we'll see where that goes. But if they don't, then it could be a bad thing. Because the U.S. companies will come in and probably be very disruptive and negative for the Canadian players, except for the two or three largest Canadian cannabis companies. Again, which is why I'd rather go to a virgin territory and set up shop and be first in the door, second in the door, and sort of grow with it in a couple of years. Other people can come and set up shop, but we already have a large market presence in those countries to begin with.
How important is organics in the long term?
What's interesting about the sector is we're forced to go to high-grade pharmaceuticals. We can't really use a lot of fertilizer or pesticides. We're already 85 to 90% organic to begin with. That extra 10% is a bit difficult to get to, but it's very doable. I think in the medical market, we did take organic around public back in the day, and it was a big deal, but ultimately it didn't result in very much of anything. I think when we move to consumer products and you have edibles and derivatives, I think it'll be a much larger differentiating factor there. But I think what the consumer will also have to understand is we're all pretty close to organic as it is. It's a very clean and friendly product. So, going that extra step is probably useful, but I think the way we're going to position ourselves is to be a little bit different, and which you'll see in terms of our rebranding. We have a new website going live soon, is we're the Conscious Cannabis Company, which we've trademarked. So what that means is, beyond being a good steward of your local communities where we're set up, which is a big part of what we do, is most of our facilities are going to be run on renewable power. So our carbon footprint is going to be pretty low. I mean, these facilities are very energy intensive. So, you know, they've got a huge carbon footprint attached to it. So us being able to, you know, provide a clean and green product is going to be unusual in the marketplace. I don't think anyone else is doing it to the degree we are. There's plenty of people going after organics. Again, it's just a part of our ethos. Do something other people are completely ignoring. And it fits in with our pedigree of being renewable power specialists anyway. So that's where our focus is. We may go organic at some point or not. We do have our hemp company called CBD Acres, which will be producing more CBD than anyone in Canada starting this year. Mm-hmm. That's largely organic.
You mentioned earlier on retail opportunities. Not a lot of LPs or even a lot of companies that have geared themselves towards retail actually have those retail licenses. Mm-hmm. How important do you think that's going to be?
I think it's important from the standpoint it allows you, because cannabis is a controlled substance, retail allows you to touch your end consumer more efficiently and directly. So you can gather data, you can get a better feel for what's selling and not selling, what people like and they don't like directly. And it extends your brand because it's a more intimate connection in how you design, at least how we're going to design our retail facilities. So it's good from that standpoint. From a cash flow standpoint, I mean, depending on where you're set up, it's a pretty low margin business. So, you know, if we've got five retail locations in Newfoundland, it's not going to move the needle too much. but it'll be interesting. It'll be good from a branding and customer feedback standpoint to extend our brand there. We will have retail in other provinces when it's possible to do. I'm pretty sure most provinces will go private retail at some point in the next little while, including the other provinces of Atlantic Canada. So, you know, we'll get up to a nice little number. And it's just a brand extension exercise, which I think is really important to do. And you can't really do it without retail, because unless they deschedule it to next to nothing, we can do more traditional advertising. That's where retail comes into play. It's really not a cash flowing thing for us. But although, interesting enough, because they're a Newfoundland contract, our economics on retail are probably better than any other cannabis retail operator in Canada right now.
This is going to be all important, I think. Right now, everyone's sort of coasting by on the, hey, we've got revenue, but losses, but it doesn't really matter because everyone's got losses. Someone's going to come along and actually start making money on this product at some point, and that's going to be a big deal.
I think so. I mean, if you look at larger companies, they don't care about losses. They go to the balance sheets to support. They just keep spending. So what's interesting about us, we went commercial. We got our first sales license in Nova Scotia in December of last year. We started selling product in January of this year. And we are already cash flow positive on ongoing operations, if you don't include our expansion capital, right away. It just goes to the way we design this company. It's lean, it's mean, it's highly efficient, right? We're not going to be spending money where it doesn't make sense. And I don't think you can look at a lot of cannabis companies that have been able to get that positive ongoing operating cash flow this quickly.
I sat down and talked to Cam Batley at Aurora and said, like, you know, wouldn't it be a good thing if everyone just kind of quitted on the buying stuff for a quarter and just let us see what you're actually making and losing? And he kind of got a look about him like the answer was yes, but the answer he was going to give me was no. Difficult for an investor to really sort of figure out where their money's really going right now, because the finances are so sort of tied in knots. Everyone excuses losses for growth, but what should an investor really look for in a company to give an indication that this thing's going to be around for 20 years?
Okay, so the top five companies have no interest in making money because they can raise money easily and keep the operations open. They just want to spread their wings as far as they can. So if you look at the largest companies, it's a different answer versus a smaller company. So if as an investor, you're looking at Canopy, Aurora, et cetera, Aphria, domestic execution is more or less priced into these stocks. It's really what they do overseas from the standpoint that makes sense. So I wouldn't necessarily be looking for cash flow positive operations anywhere. What you're going to be looking for is what the dominant position they've achieved in Canada. Can they replicate this in other jurisdictions, whether it's in Europe, South America, South Africa, or Australia, or wherever, in a similar fashion to the way they did it here in Canada? Because that's what's going to be driving their stock prices on a go-forward basis. It's really where are these new opportunities coming from, because there's really not a lot of upside. It's more downside risk than Canadian execution than upside risk. The only downside is if you're trying to read their financial statements and all that, there's so many esoteric elements to their business plans that you're never, ever going to get a clean picture. So if you're looking for upside in these larger names, you're more liquid, it's what are they doing overseas? I mean, that's really, I know it sounds kind of high level and not very sophisticated, but that's what's going to be driving on a go forward. On the smaller guys, the question is, all right, how are they going to survive when supply exceeds demand, or supply, you know, more or less equals demand? How are they going to compete head to head against the big guys? This is the medium, anything that's sort of like a 500 million market cap and down is probably a good way to segment the market. Mm-hmm. What is their competitive advantage versus, Canopy coming in, swooping into a market and flooding the market with product? How are they going to get head to head? I'd say 95% of those companies have no answer for that. I think we do, because we've got offtake agreements and we've got international deals coming. If at some point I do a single dollar in Canada, I'll still be a very highly profitable business. So that's what we're building towards. How do we compete against the big guys 2 years down the line, or a year and a half down the line, when there's, you know, the supply shortage is not an issue anymore, and you got to go head to head? That's what we're building towards. So it kind of looks like we're doing some weird things in a lot of different places, but it's all geared towards surviving that and thriving on the other side of that. As an investor, I would really avoid anything that's outside of the large guys in the cannabis indexes. The smaller companies may not have gone on their hockey stick upside yet, but I'd sort of position it somewhat self-serving that they've missed the boat. All we're simply saying is from the next wave of cannabis companies, we're the least risky. I don't want to underscore that. I think that's important because most of our contemporaries that are at our level probably won't be around 12 to 24 months from now.
I think that's a fair assessment. And I think one thing worth noting for those listening is, I think it was 2014, maybe 2015, Karim, you wrote a report on the weed industry that, man, I heard just about everybody quoting for about 6 months, basically building their businesses on in terms of what was going to happen in the business. I think you were infamously spot on. So if you're giving people the heads up now, then that's something that should take some consideration in.
Oh, thank you for that. Again, I just went early, and the whole mandate of that report was you know, read the tea leaves on the regulations and then try to give investors sort of like a guidebook. How do you value these companies? What should you be looking for? And the answers then were different. Then a year later, it was completely different answers. And today, it's a completely different way of looking at the companies, which is a good thing. A sector should evolve. So at some point, you know, when we talked about things like funded capacity, that made sense maybe 2 years ago. Today, it's a useless metric, but people still use it, unfortunately. The way I would look at things today is who's got contracted offtakes. That is all that matters. I don't care how many square feet you have under your canopy or under a grow or under construction. Do you have certainty on where that product's going to be sold once you're selling? And who can actually grow well to meet those contracts is important as well. That's all that anyone should really, at the end of the day, care about. Because at the end of the day, I can get someone else to grow for me, even if I don't build hundreds of thousands of square feet in Canada. There'll always be somebody who can provide me a product. And at some point, everyone will figure out how to grow a quality product, the ones that are still left standing. So the downstream companies that are currently vertically integrated with grow operations, it's what are they doing downstream? And that's the metric I'd like the industry to move to next, away from funded capacity, because when you can't value these things on EBITDA anytime soon, you've got to look at some other Easter egg where is it doing it. I think that's probably the way to go. And there's very few good companies with offtakes outside of the top five biggest names in the space.
I think when it comes to the point where we're getting large fields of wheat grown in Africa and we're getting WTO challenges on letting that product into Canada to compete with our own, those low quality, high quantity guys might really struggle at that point.
Indeed. Yeah, some of these trade treaties and cross-border considerations are really going to test various governments and jurisdictions as we move forward. Again, which is why I always like to have a high-quality product made in Canada. In some countries, don't get me wrong, we're going to grow outdoors and at the lowest possible cost, and it's going to be on the lower end of the quality range. It just is, but you're going to turn down into derivatives and other things, which is fine. But yeah, it's a global market now, and there are plenty of jurisdictions coming out with medical programs and in some cases recreational programs. And that's around the corner. So again, when you're looking at these larger companies that are trying to spread their wings very quickly overseas, I think that's the right approach, because Canada has a bit of a knowledge or branding leadership in the space right now. In about 6 to 12 months, if not maybe a little bit longer, that won't be the case. So, you know, take advantage of it while you can, which is where I spend most of my time for the same reason. It's getting our international stuff lined up, not so much what we're doing in Canada. And it's going to be interesting for the reasons every jurisdiction has its own little quirk. And when you expose that jurisdiction to another jurisdiction, which may have certain deficiencies, it's going to lead to a lot of headbutting at federal levels and at the World Trade Organization levels, or potentially at the UN levels or in other sort of multi-jurisdictional bodies on a go-forward basis, because there's a lot of money to be made here. There's a lot of volumes to be moved across cross-border. And no one really knows what it's going to look like. I mean, the only problem with Canada right now is our regs require us to produce some very expensive products. If the regulators are going to get their act together and produce a more streamlined regulatory regime where we can grow at a food grade, for example, for recreational cannabis instead of a high quality farmer grade, then we may be okay. Otherwise, pretty much most of these facilities won't have a place to sell their product because we can't compete with even some of the most expensive Western European economies because our regs just don't allow us to.
Right now, they're struggling to even just compete with the guy behind the dumpster behind the pub. So,
You know, well, that's the other problem, right? The black market's going to have the higher quality product. We could have the higher quality product than them because we've got money to throw at the problem. But the regs have to be rationalized. And if the whole point of the recreational program here in Canada, if you believe the politicians, was to shut down the black illegal market, these regs don't allow us to do it. It's too difficult. So we're trying to address it as much as we can through biome, through technology, and smaller grow rooms and bringing the right growers in through microcultivators and all that. But as an industry itself, we'll always be one tier below them because they can get away with certain things we can't. So if we competed on equal footing, and I'm going a bit of a tangent here, these years and months were spent designing this recreational program, and most of the effort was put from the regulatory standpoint on law enforcement, not on the actual regulating the producers like us. If we could have scrapped that entire thing, and if we just competed from head to head from day one, you wouldn't need any regs. We would kill the black market pretty quickly just through market dynamics, because we'd have a lower price point, higher quality, more product variety, better distribution channels, because we'll have money to throw at the problem that the black market does not have. But, you know, we're basically fighting the black market with two hands tied behind our back. And the government solution is more regulations, which unfortunately makes things worse.
More regulations and taxes on medicine.
Yep, which again is insane. I mean, Literally, if you look at some of these medicines out there, got some very sick children, and parents are paying $4,000 or $5,000 out of pocket to improve the quality of life of their children. It doesn't need to be that. We can probably do the same thing even without insurance coverage for $1,000 a month out of pocket, but the regs don't allow for it.
Ben, I want to thank you for chatting today. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and has been for years. I look forward to talking to you again in a few months.
My pleasure, and looking forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, man.
You've been listening to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. For disclosure statements and more info, please visit www.equity.guru.